Welcome back to another Riddles in the Dark episode. We're doing this at a slightly unusual time. It's actually a Monday night at 11:30 Eastern Time. We sprung this completely as a surprise on the Tolkien Professor fans on the Facebook page, and somehow we still managed to get a huge number of people, although an entirely different cross-section of the fandom than we usually get on Tuesday mornings at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. So we're doing this because Corey's about to go on a huge trip. I'm going to a conference. There's just chaos in our lives. We knew this is going to be our last chance, or else you guys would be going weeks and weeks without episodes, since it seems as though I'm apparently in no hurry to finish editing the previous ones.
Wasn't going to mention that, but
yes. So here we go. On this week's episode, we are going to be talking about talking animals, which I'm sure will inundate the films. I think Trish has already dubbed this episode "Wargs and Eagles and Bears." Oh my! So
yes. Yes, yes, fitting enough. Yeah, and I would just like to again both commend and thank the faithful people who have joined us semi-spontaneously here in the middle of the night, East Coast time. I know that some of you are not East Coast time, and so it's a little bit more convenient for you than it is for the rest of us. But no, this is excellent. I mean, we have 17 people who have shown up live with like an hour's warning in the middle of the night. So that is pretty awesome. So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to talking about this. I should mention actually that the place that I am going tomorrow is pretty exciting. The reason that we're not able to do it at our normal time, because I am headed over to England for the Tolkien Society's Return of the Ring Conference. It is probably the biggest Tolkien conference, event of the year this year. It is very exciting. I am looking forward to being there. There will be lots of, I hope to do at least one live sort of Q&A session, sort of a live from the Return of the Ring Q&A session or something, maybe with some guests from the conference. So we'll see if we can get that together sometime, I think possibly Saturday of this week. Looks, based on the schedule for the conference, looks like a day in which I might be able to do that. But anyway, so I am excitedly heading over for a long weekend of Tolkien activities, which will be great fun. But anyway, as I said, so thanks for joining us, those of you who can. Now, today's episode, what we've been talking about, we've been in the midst of a sequence of kind of, it's sort of, proceeding through the plot of the, of the first half of The Hobbit, but it's not just the plot itself. The sort of the focus all the way through this series of Riddles in the Dark episodes has been Bilbo's character development and where we see his character, being developed and moving along in the books, and then in particular, of course, how that kind of thing might translate.
Wow, are we going to find a way to connect this week's episode to that somehow? That would be quite a feat.
I am interested. I'm certainly going to be interested to be talking about that, because I do think that these scenes with his being treed by the wargs and his being carried off by the eagles occupy a sort of a really interesting transitional place in Bilbo's development here, because what we see, and this I think is one of the things that's really fascinating about Tolkien's depiction of Bilbo's character in the book, is that he doesn't undergo sudden changes. Like, it's, the story that one might sort of expect to find with Bilbo's character isn't really the one that actually happens. This is not really like, he turns into adventurer and soon is like, a hardened pro. He's not. He's had his big turning point. He's had, the finding of the ring, the escape from Gollum, the getting out of the Misty Mountains completely by himself, is like, that was a huge deal. That was the moment that he officially, earned his like adventurer's, membership card. But at that point, he's still, not only is he nowhere near done, outwardly, he's actually very little changed. And this is the thing that I think is so interesting, is that it's still going to be a long time. Bilbo will eventually, in the story, kind of jump in and become the real leader of their expedition, as the narrator will say. You know, he will be, you know, pulling the dwarves' bacon out of the fire again and again, to misapply the metaphor that's used in this chapter in The Hobbit. But anyway, he's going to be doing that again and again. He's going to be the one who's constantly saving them, but we're still a long ways from that. And after this turning point, when, you know, he has just been reintroduced to the dwarves in that scene, which is so important in the book, but which we talked about last time, that they're almost certainly, I think, going to change in the film. That is the scene where he sort of sneaks in and they have a new respect for him and realize that he is a first-class burglar after all. And there's that elaborate scene where he and Balin reintroduce themselves to each other and have that formal greeting as if they're now meeting again for the first time. So, you know, we have that moment, which seems to indicate, now he and the dwarves are starting off on a fresh footing. You know, this is now the new Bilbo, except new Bilbo looks just like the old Bilbo. I mean, the new Bilbo is throughout this doing nothing but complaining about how hungry he is. And being completely helpless, like having to be carried around and hoisted up trees and then complaining more about how hungry he is. He still doesn't do anything.
But let's not let, you know, all this wonderful deep character development get in the way of talking about talking singing animals too.
No, we won't. We're transitioning into the talking singing animals. Because of course, along the way, you know, since we had gotten to this place, we do want to talk about the talking singing animals, because that does raise some very specific issues with the films. I think both thinking back to the relationship between The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings films, but also, I mean, I think it really raises some questions, which are questions which have been, I think, some of the most fundamental, even kind of preliminary questions that people have always had about the Hobbit film. Namely, like, what is its tone going to be? And how persistent is that tone going to be? Is it going to reflect the lighthearted, often comical tone of the book? And you know, it's one thing to say, like, okay, we're still going to get Fat Bomber and, you know, some like dwarven buffoonery, and that's going to be funny, you know, so there's going to be, and Bilbo will still be a source of humor on many occasions. So yeah, okay, so there you go. That's what's going to happen. That's how we're going to get preserve some of that same tone, and we're still going to, apparently, I mean, it looks like we're going to get some version of the dwarven scene in the kitchen, right, where the dwarves are throwing the plates around and everything. That there was a bit of that in the trailer, wasn't there?
Yes,
if I'm remembering that correctly.
So we
can see. All right, so there's definitely some attempts, and, you know, Peter Jackson and the actors have said several times that, you know, it's designed to be funny, and, you know, it does try to preserve that lighthearted tone. How far is it going
to
go?
I am most interested to watch some giant misshapen hyena monsters singing songs about dwarves and whatnot.
Right. See, now you're thinking about the wargs,
because
they
that's
were represented
what wargs are,
in the
right?
Two towers.
Yeah, right. Giant hyena animals. That's what wargs are, right?
Right. Well, exactly. See, and this is where, this is what's going to be really interesting, because there are two things in the background that really change By the background, I mean the Lord of the Rings films, right? Things that people will remember. We've seen wolf riders, right? We have, as you say, we've seen wargs. We've seen wargs in that, you know, in the scene with the Rohirrim, with the goblin orc riders that go out from Isengard after the Rohirrim. So theoretically, we already know what they look like, and as you pointed out, they look like hyenas and not like wolves. And they're certainly not very articulate, and it's hard to imagine them having a conversation or indeed even really like a chief in the same way that they seem to have in the book. I would also point out we've seen eagles, and you know, we've seen lots of swooping, rescuing eagles at various points in the Lord of the Rings films. But what we have not seen is them talk. And it is to me an interesting question. Are we going to see any conversations with the eagles? Will the eagles ever speak? Because that's going to be jarring, because the eagles have been on screen so often and we've heard them, you know, make an eagle cry, you know, like the, we've heard them vocalize, but we certainly have not heard them talk. So I think now Stephen asks, you know, makes a really interesting point about Roark the raven, who speaks common, and the thrush who obviously doesn't. Now, of course, both Roark and the thrush are firmly in film 2 or 3 material, so we're not going to talk about those in too much detail because we are trying to pace ourselves.
Right.
However,
come on, Stephen. You know,
but Stephen raises a good point. That is, we have an emphatically talking bird later on. But see, Stephen, the main thing I would say about that, not to get into Roark too much yet, but I would say it's in a totally different situation because we don't have that preconceived idea. Like, okay, we saw Krabine from Dunland flying around, but that didn't really mean anything to us. And it's not going to be shocking to actually. You know, meet a bird that speaks, because it's going to be a different species. It's going to be looking different. The eagles, you're talking about reintroducing essentially, you know, what at least to all appearances is going to look like a familiar character from The Lord of the Rings, and now making it talk for the first time. So that's going to be to me pretty. A pretty big shift. Now, Matthew points out that they do show Gandalf talking with the moth at the top of Isengard, right? So it's possible Gandalf could converse with eagles, but not in a way that the audience could understand, and he'll have to translate for his companions. Matthew, that seems to me pretty likely. It's hard for me to imagine that they're going to actually make the eagles speak in the common tongue. That I just think would be too much of a shift. And of course, and I can't remember who it was that brought this up last time when this came up. Brandon, was it you? I'm not sure. I can't remember. But basically, the issue of it's going to look really Narnia if you've got animals that speak all of a sudden. And to be frank, this is a big issue. It's a big issue in The Hobbit as a whole, because we're not just talking about eagles. There are a lot of talking animals in this book. The spiders speak the common speech too. And the fact that they are being overheard, now that's a little bit easier for me to see them just cutting out entirely. You know, that we're not going to get the sort of funny dialogue among the spiders.
If we're not getting the dialogue among the spiders, will we get Bilbo shouting Addercop? Stole that from Vanarin Green, by the way.
From Vanarin, yeah. Yes. Boy, will I be disappointed if the word Addercop is never uttered.
On your note, I see what you're saying about the shift. I don't think it really matters. I think that talking animals are just too intrinsic to the nature and feel of the Hobbit, and that people will be looking forward to that. And I think people will have short memories and they won't care that the eagles in the Lord of the Rings films didn't really have an opportunity to talk, and they can easily explain the talking wolves by just essentially calling, you know, just making them look different and behave differently and just sort of think, you know, pitching them as separate breed of wolves. I think it's pretty easy to make them talk if they wanted to.
Well, I mean, okay. I think they could. I don't think they will. I mean, I would. This isn't our official prediction, of course, for this episode. But here's a free
prediction.
You're
going on the record.
I'm going on the record. The eagles aren't going to talk. The wolves aren't going to talk. The spiders aren't going to talk. I think they're going to minimize animal speech. I do expect the raven to talk. Roach, I believe, will appear and will talk. And we will get some kind of like thrush language thing, though how they're going to do the thrush's message to Bard, I'm not quite sure. But again, that's later on. I'm not going to worry about that too much right now. But if I had to go on the record right now, if somebody were forcing me, which nobody is, so I don't know why I'm doing it, but if someone were going to force me to predict how many total talking animals will appear in all three Hobbit films combined, I would say one. Roach the Raven.
That would be very disappointing.
That is my. Vinarin is suggesting we get subtitles for the animals. That would be awesome. They could do the Bard thing that way, though. How anticlimactic would that be? You know, like that, like in the pivotal moment right before Smaug is killed, to have the thrush just being like, brr, brr, with subtitles. Boy, that could really undermine the drama of the moment, couldn't it? But anyway, I am like continually adverting back to the thrush and the raven,
that are not even in the
first
film. But
the thing to keep in mind,
come on, man.
Yeah, exactly.
No, discipline.
Yeah. Okay, first film. Discipline. So here it is. I think that with the wargs, the thing to keep in mind, the wargs don't talk. In the book, they don't speak in the common language, which is really interesting because the spiders do. It's something that Tolkien did consistently throughout The Hobbit, and it's one of the things it's very interesting because it's one of the ways in which Tolkien, this might be too strong a way to put it, but actually like breaks his own habits, you know, goes against his own sort of personal and private, you know, pleasures and enjoyments in not inventing languages, or at least explaining linguistic connections and things, and having a simple, like, suspension of disbelief situation with the spiders in particular. There is no excuse for the spiders to be speaking in the common tongue. At least when the orcs in the Two Towers are speaking in the common tongue, and so Merry and Pippin can understand them when they're overhearing that, there's an explanation that's given in the book. Like, they have to speak in the common tongue because they speak different dialects and can't understand each other's orc speech, and so they all can speak some version of the common tongue, so they speak that in order to be able to communicate with each other. And we see them lapsing into their orc dialect when they're talking within their own internal groups. Like when the ones who are not the Uruk-hai, who are complaining about Ugluk behind his back at the very beginning, that is before Ugluk lops their heads off, they lapse into their own orcish dialect and speak, you know, and we get like a full line of transcribed orcish language before Ugluk comes in and they all start speaking common again. So again, we're given internally within that story a plausible explanation for why on earth these characters would be speaking in the common tongue that the hobbits could understand. There is no excuse given, no attempt at an excuse given as to why these spiders are speaking amongst themselves the common speech. That they would have a language isn't surprising. That they would speak in common is utterly inexplicable. But again, interestingly, the wargs don't. The wargs don't speak in the common language. They are speaking to each other. They're given a language. They're not simply bestial. They have an intelligence, and sort of have like the ability to plan and stuff, and seem to have some kind of you know, hierarchy and whatever.
Right.
But I mean, their language is described as growling and yelping. But Bilbo can't understand it, so he has no idea what they're talking about. And that's repeated several times. The fact that Bilbo can't understand them, that is. Yeah, here's the description of the language. I said this is one of them, those moments where you can see Tolkien, like, briefly, very briefly, kind of indulging his own interest in linguistics and stuff. So it's right when they, in my edition in the trade paperback, the Houghton Mifflin trade paperback, page 93, in chapter 6, of course, out of the frying pan into the fire, right after the wargs have sniffed out all the trees that have dwarves, and or hobbit and wizard in them, it says, these they guarded too, while all the rest, hundreds and hundreds it seemed, went and sat in a great circle in the glade, and in the middle of the circle was a great gray wolf. He spoke to them in the dreadful language of the wargs. Gandalf understood it. Bilbo did not, but it sounded terrible to him, and as if all their talk was about cruel and wicked things, as it was. So I get that the fact that their language itself sounds like it is like that, like they are talking about cruel and wicked things, because their sound, their language, like, phonetically reflects the wickedness that they are speaking, and that they habitually speak about in their language. And then again, right at the very beginning of the next paragraph, I will tell you what Gandalf heard, though Bilbo did not understand it. Again, we have it emphasized that Bilbo didn't understand it. And so we only get a paraphrase. We don't get, because this is Bilbo's, you know, sort of derived from Bilbo's diary, so we never get dialogue from the wargs because he doesn't understand it. He just gets the gist of it from Gandalf later on. And so we get several paragraphs of paraphrase of what they're discussing. But again, the thing that we do get, though we don't get speech, though we don't get dialogue, what we do get is them acting very, you know, civilizedly, in a sense. That is, we certainly organizedly. We have them sitting around in a circle, forming a great circle with their chief sort of in the middle and apparently, like, orating. Right? I mean, he's, like, walking up and down and speaking, addressing all of the rest of the gathered wolves in their language. So he's, I don't know, he's having, like, a Theoden moment, right? You know, where he's addressing the troops right before battle. But anyway, death! I don't know, maybe that's what he's saying. But
a red day.
So,
or I guess a red night. I guess it kind of was a red night once they set all those trees on fire.
Right, exactly. So, well, of course, that wasn't their idea. But the day may come when the wolves shall fail, but it is not this day. Anyway, I don't know. So we don't get direct dialogue from the wargs. But again, thinking about this now for the film, you know, how do they treat that? Do they represent the wargs? In that way, and again, I don't think they do. I am hopeful, based upon that one image of a wolf that we get, in that big scroll image that we looked at a few weeks back. We did see a wolf next to the burning tree in that scroll, and I think it didn't look like a hyena to me. It looked much more like a wolf than a hyena. So hopefully they're going to play the, like, it's a different species card. Like, they'd have the different, their radically different appearing species of orc.
I hope so. If those things from the Two Towers, never show up ever again on screen, it will be too soon.
Mm-hmm. They were pretty ugly. And yeah, so I think that, you know, these definitely looked more wolfish. But in fact, see, that's one of the other things. They look more wolfish. They look more like, and the others were more monstrous. You know, they were more, I think they look more like hyenas because they didn't want to just appear like regular wolves. But these do appear like regular wolves, and especially it's wolves. I mean, I'm sorry, like, back to the Narnia thing, we had talking wolves in Narnia, like a pack of talking wolves were some of the chief antagonists in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe film. I mean, as they were in the book, but even more prominently in the film. So we have this very, very clear, and I would suspect still, even after some time, quite present visual image that I think is going to be an association that they would have a hard time knocking. I don't think we're going to get it. And it looks like, based purely upon appearances, it looks like they're going to represent them as being more animal, less, you know, less sentient. I don't know. Vonarin is asking, where is this scroll? We put up a link to that, didn't we, on the Riddles in the Dark page?
The link to the scroll?
To the scroll, didn't we? When we talked about it a couple weeks back?
I could have sworn we did.
I think we did. So, yeah, Vonarin, if you go back to...
I'm going to go look for it, and if I can find it, I will... I'll send it as an answer to Vonarin.
Yeah, there we go. That's good. Larry, that's a great idea. Larry says, make the wargs like the wolf from the Neverending Story and you can't fail. Totally agree. That wolf was completely terrifying. I had nightmares as a child about that thing. Totally agree.
All right, now, here Steven, we go. I found it. The link to the movie scroll. It? Woohoo! Here it comes, Vonarin.
Excellent.
Type Steven answer says, here.
And I think very plausibly, I'd be willing to bet that the wargs just stop and tree them, and the goblins catch up so quickly that there isn't time for wolf moot. It also makes more sense in a film sense, since we move things along quicker that way. You know, Steven, I agree. I do suspect that that's what we're going to see. I don't think we're going to get a whole lot of time. There's definitely something lost there. I mean, there is definitely something lost with the... if they basically downplay those so that the wolves look normal, I mean, they could easily have, you know, some kind of dialogue, say, between Gandalf and Bilbo or Gandalf and one of the dwarves or something, when they're like, there are wolves after us, and be like, those are no ordinary wolves or whatever. I mean, they could try to establish in the minds of the audience that these wolves are, you know, much more intelligent and work together with the goblins. And then, of course, the goblins show up right afterwards, can totally see that. But I do think that something will be lost, and I think that something will be lost from, like, for instance, one thing that I think might be lost is the enumeration at the Battle of Five Armies, because, of course, the wargs and the goblins are two of the five armies in question. But if the wolves just appear to be like animal sidekicks of the goblins, it's going to be hard to make them appear as like kind of an equal combatants there. I think that they, so as I say, I would be afraid that something would be lost there, but I would suspect that. Now, of course, we have to think about, and this is to me another big question in the sense that it relates to the overall choices that they are going to be making, or indeed at this point have made, about the tone of the film as a whole. Because see, that moment, and this is something that Tolkien does so delicately, and it's I am just kind of in amazement so many times throughout the book at how well Tolkien balances comedy and drama. You know, how he can make a scene funny. Like, you can be laughing at the antagonists. You can be laughing at the monsters without reducing the fact that it's really a dramatic scene. The spiders are a really good example of this, and we'll talk about the spiders more. The spiders obviously deserve an episode of their own, and we'll get to that. But the wargs are another good example. You know, the wargs, you know, have them trapped, and they're going to hold them there until the goblins show up. This is obviously a very serious situation. They are in very serious danger. We're told, the narrator tells us, how scared Gandalf, wizard though he is getting at overhearing what they're saying. But nevertheless, we get comedy. Gandalf then starts setting pine cones on fire and throwing down the burning pine cones, which catch the wolves on fire and in like multicolored fire. He's making like blue and green flames and stuff, and the dwarves are all cheering as the wolves are running around and you know, sort of like trying to stamp out the fire, but it's very uncanny fire and won't be stamped out. I mean, that moment again, it's not totally slapstick in that moment, but it is comical, and the wargs are made to look silly. You know, like the biggest stroke in that little like mini battle between Gandalf and the wargs is when the chief wolf gets a pine cone that hits him in the nose, and his nose is rather badly singed. I mean, you know, it's not high drama at that point. And now again, Tolkien does this without, I think, really taking away from the tension of that moment. I mean, it still is scary, but it's one of the things that he does so consistently throughout the book, that to sort of keep it, it's the way in which I think that he most sensitively takes into account the juvenile audience that he intends it for. He doesn't do this by dumbing it down. He doesn't do this by making it less scary, you know, that is like by making sure that nothing bad happens, you know, or like keeping the monsters out of it. He puts the monsters in, and he puts these really very serious situations in, and then later on in the book, increasingly more real suffering and tragedy, but he does use comedy to basically kind of diffuse slightly, just to keep it from being absolutely terrified, as terrified as I was of that wolf in the Neverending Story. And I see that Jesse shared my opinion that Gmork ruined his childhood, he says. It wasn't quite so bad for me. I got over it. But but anyway, yeah, so that's Tolkien never allows things just to get overwhelming, I think. And he gives kids kind of a lifeline, I think, through comedy, but again, without simply derailing, without simply taking apart the dramatic tension, you know, and the sort of the fear of those moments. But again, in the film, are they going to mingle that kind of, you know, buffoonery with dramatic moments? Now, we have some precedent for that kind of thing, like Gimli at Helm's Deep.
It is kind of hard to... Yeah, actually, that's a good point. I was going to say, it's really hard to imagine them pulling this off on screen, like, you know, terrifying wolves and then, you know, pine cones bouncing off their noses. It might not mix well. But yeah, the Gimli stuff in The Lord of the Rings, you're right, it did mix in there. I mean, I detested it, but...
Yeah, I know, and it's
but less because it didn't fit, and more because it turned Gimli into an oaf, and he's not an oaf. Gimli is awesome.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. Exactly. I do think that they, yeah. I mean, there are things that they have done. There are things that they could do. They can still make the dwarves be kind of acting like, you know, somewhat comical in this, but see what the whole bouncing the pine cone off the chief wolf's nose, that's exactly the kind of comedy that I don't think they can do. If they make the dramatic action itself, the conflict and the beginning of the fire, for crying out loud, if they make that funny, then, you know, I think it seems to me in the film medium that's going to have a much clumsier impact on audience reception than it can have in the book. So I don't see them making that comical in that way. I think that the actual conflict with the wolves, you know, maybe we'll get some comic relief from, you know, maybe, you know, like Bomber will be buffoonish up his tree, or, you know, because that's certainly something they can do, is playing the getting up the trees for laughs, as indeed Tolkien does too. I mean, poor Bilbo not being able to reach the bottom branch and running around from the trunk of one tree to another, you know, jumping and falling short and trying to get up in the tree, like that's kind of funny too. So I could see that being done for laughs, but the actual, you know, Gandalf using magic to try to fight off the wolves, hard to see that being treated comically in the film. But anyway, so I'm not sure. I think it's so again, this is why I say I think it has larger implications for the overall
tone of the film. Yeah, this is a good.
This is a fantastic
sort of deciding point. You know what I mean? Like, if you really think that they're going to play up the humor, then this would probably be a good scene to do it and to match the book. And if you really think that they're going to diminish the humor in favor of, you know, drama and action, this scene almost certainly will have some of the humor reduced.
I do think the humor will be reduced. And I certainly don't think that the wargs are going to end up getting played for humor. I'd be surprised to see it. I suspect that because we know they're going to be doing, at the same time as they are, they say they are anyway, attempting to retain the you know, lighthearted spirit of the book, they are also doing an epic film trilogy now, you know, so
yes.
So they are clearly going to be playing up the high seriousness of various parts of it. And there's plenty of opportunity for comic relief, but again, it's different. It's a totally different thing to have, like, Gimli at Helm's Deep, where you have a moment of high drama which has occasional comic relief inserted into it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can still do, you know, though I do agree with you about Gimli, and I too sort of wept for Gimli's character when I saw the film the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's a very popular complaint, and I think a very fair one. But you can still do the, like, you're going to have to toss me bit, you know, sequence in the middle of Helm's Deep and not lose the, you know, sort of the climax of the battle.
The seriousness of the battle, yeah.
It's funny when that happens and Aragorn, you know, sort of gives him that look and then tosses him across. But as soon as he does and then jumps over after him, we're back at, like, high drama and the two of them, you know, defending the gates. But again, that's comic relief. That is like a brief moment of the relief of tension in the middle of it. It is not making the action itself funny, you know, which again is what Tolkien actually does do at a couple different places.
Vanarin says that Peter Jackson has said on several occasions this will be a funny movie. I think that is true, but it's sort of a question of what does that mean exactly? Like, is it going to be funnier as in he's gonna add a few extra jokes? Or is it going to be funny in the sense of, you know, like Tolkien's type of humor?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I should even explain further what I mean by that. You know, I mean, like, the way that he will, even just in his wording and in the references that he'll make, to lighthearted is the way that I would. That I would emphasize it. I mean, when Bilbo throws the first stone at the spider and he falls out of the web, whack, dead. You know, there's a lightheartedness. There's a comedic touch to some of his metaphors and similes as well. Like when he cuts the first dwarf free and he's jerking his arms and legs like one of those funny toys bobbing on a wire, like one of those wooden toys that bobs its legs up and down when you jiggle it, hanging from a wire. Those moments are moments where he really sort of diffuses things by either saying something in a funny way or bringing in a sort of a lighthearted comparison. But in the film, that's, I mean, are seriously, like, Peter Jackson is going to make the fighters, the spider scene funny? Like, we're going to be laughing while Bilbo throws rocks at the spiders? We are, I mean, I am laughing in the book when that happens, you know, like at you know, old Tom Noddy, old Big Body, you know, old Tom Noddy, all Big Body. I just, that's not, it's hard to see that tone. So yeah, I agree. I'm not sure. I'm not yet sure what exactly he means by it. When he says it's going to be funnier. Because the fact is, at the end of the day, the number one thing people are going to be expecting when they go in to sit down for that film is something in the same register, general register
as Lord of the Rings.
You know, I mean, they're not going to be like, that was high drama. This is light comedy. That's not what people are expecting.
They expect
it's
swords,
not what people are going to go to see.
Action, fighting, I don't know what else. All that dramatic action stuff.
Dwarf romance.
Yes.
You know, all the things that people go to these movies expecting. Yeah, exactly. No, and Sharon was just pointing about the Bilbo singing when he attacks the spiders as a good illustration right before I said it. Exactly. That's yeah. Now again, we'll here I am wandering up to the spiders again. We'll be saving that for another episode. But again, that's the kind of thing that I don't see them doing. The fire, the setting of the fire, and you know the. Any fighting that they do against the goblins and wargs and the, you know, their, the goblins and wargs fighting against them and setting their trees on fire, this I don't see being done comically. This is going to be a dramatic moment in the film, and it almost has to be. So I think it's hard for me not to see that, at the end of the day, the wargs are going to end up being more beast, less, you know, less sentient partners with the dwarves or with the goblins. That's going to be and I think, frankly, I think the same of the eagles. You know, I think the eagles are also going to be. I think they're going to be more beastified. You know that they're going to be basically high functioning animals, and that's what I would expect to see. Again, not that as so often. I don't hope I'm wrong, but I do hope I'm wrong. But that's what I would pretty well expect.
Really?
Yeah, it is. And you know, as there are several people who are accusing me of being too. Of being too negative, of being too down. I don't.
Enough with the snark already.
Yeah. I don't actually. To me, this is not. At least I don't feel pessimistic when I'm saying this. It seems to me like these are choices that have to be made in adaptation, and I honestly think it makes a lot of sense. You know, it's hard for me to see. Or rather, let me say that the other way around. It is much easier for me to see how you can make your story, you can achieve your storytelling goals as a filmmaker more easily by letting the beasts be more beasts and less Narnian, because it's hard to go middle ground. I think between those two things, like having the talking, you know, basically, where do you go between, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? You know, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver with her sewing machine, you know, and everything else, and Mr. Beaver with his hatchet, and then just, you know, animals as animals, even if they're friendly or hostile or whatever. It's hard to do a middle ground. It really is. You know, and you can do, I mean, I think, and basically, again, I think that, you know, my prediction there, my overall prediction about that is just following along with what we saw in The Lord of the Rings. And I think, and now I've already forgotten who it was, who brought up the Gandalf and the Moth thing, on
that's right.
On Orthon. But even there, you see, like, that's not, those are animals being animals. It's Gandalf being special because he can communicate with them in their own language. And he can, you know, so he can, like, Gandalf is cool because he can talk to moths, right? But it's not that the moth is, like, especially powerful or cool or, like, super mothly, right? And the eagles are really cool. Like, those are awesome eagles. But again, it's like because Gandalf was able to get them a message, and he seems to have some kind of rapport with them. Because notice, like, they're all about Gandalf, too, when they come in the second time at the end of the films and take Gandalf to go find Frodo and Sam and attack the Nazgul. We're not shown much that is, you know, extra beastly, extra animalistic about them.
I'm still optimistic. We're going to see talking eagles.
Okay.
What about Radagast the Brown? You think he'll be talking to animals?
He somehow convinced, like, apparently a bunch of birds to go under his hat, so he must be able to talk to them.
Yeah, and some giant rabbits to pull his sled.
To pull his sled, yeah. So,
also Santa Claus in Middle
Earth. Right.
Bizarre Santa Claus.
Right. I don't know. Yeah, you see, Sharon is going with the prediction that Gandalf is going to act as an interpreter, that he's going to explain what the wargs are saying. If we have any overheard warg conversation, again, it's going to be just Gandalf, which is, of course, very true to the book. Gandalf is the only one who can understand what the wargs are saying, and that he will also serve as interpreter of the eagles. And Sharon, I suspect that you're right. At least, let me say it this way. That would be by far the easiest thing for them to do. I think it's going to be hard.
I think you're completely wrong. I don't believe you at all, Sharon.
Okay.
Kate Neville wants to know if Radagast the Brown will be whistling "Talk to the Animals." I don't understand that reference. I'm guessing it's a song.
As long as he's not whistling "Zippity Doo-Dah," I'll be happy enough. it's a Dr. Doolittle reference. Yes, of course.
Oh.
They get a pass for that. Like, I'm fine. I am totally, like, you know, we know. It's like the one thing that we know about Radagast. There is a small list of facts that we have in hand about Radagast the Brown, and I just gave one of them, that he's called the Brown for some reason. And I know we're told more. He went back and filled in more. You know, you've got the essay on the Astari in Unfinished Tales and stuff, and I know we're told more about Radagast there. And, you know, like, I know. But, you know, within the primary canon, there's very little to work with. And okay, so we get the stuff from Unfinished Tales, but, like, what are they going to bring that in? Like, are they going to bring up Orome? I don't think so. You know, so what we get is that he is, that birds and beasts are especially his friends. That is one of the only significant facts that we have about Radagast, and that, of course, that he's honest. So obviously he's going to have a rapport with animals. Like, that's like the one mandatory thing about Radagast the Brown. I've said before when we were talking about, you know, like in the wake of the trailer, when the trailer came out, and even more the CinemaCon stuff, when we first heard rumors of the fabulous rabbit sled, and the birds under his hat. You know, I don't have much of a problem if I have to sacrifice a character to comic relief. I'd way rather it be Radagast than Gimli. I mean,
yes.
Radagast might be a hoot for all I know. I mean, you know, maybe he is a joker. Can't rule it out. I got no evidence to the contrary. You know, so
yes, I'm fine with that.
I'm fine.
Radagast
with
the Brown. Let's sacrifice him to comedic relief.
Yep.
I'm also fine with throwing a Nazgul or two to that.
for comic relief.
Yes.
Okay. Brandon, all of the evidence that we have heard suggests that there is. Didn't that come up at Comic-Con too? Am I remembering that correctly? That there was confirmation. There was like a second sighting of the rabbit sled.
Yes.
At Comic-Con. I know that was in the... And, of course, Brandon, all I've got to go on here is secondhand accounts. I wasn't at either place. I haven't seen any of that footage. But there has been reported, you know, now corroborated visual, you know, sort of secondhand to me, evidence that Radagast, in fact, will be seen being pulled in some kind of sled
yep.
by a team of unusually large rabbits. So, you know... I don't know. I'm totally in like benefit of the doubt mode on that one. Like that sounds to me like on the drawing board, that doesn't sound to me like the greatest of ideas. I mean, if somebody came to me and was like, okay, I've got a concept. Radagast being, you know, riding on a sled pulled by rabbits. What do you think? I would say you're insane, but hey, you know, like it maybe it'll be great. I don't know. But as I say, I'm not too bothered about it. And Kate, you ask exactly the crucial question that I've been trying to avoid. So I'll mention it and then carry on avoiding it. Kate's question is, what about Bjorn's animals? and my answer is, we'll talk about that in a couple weeks. I want to do Bjorn next. So
All right. I think Jan McCormick also makes a very good point that likely Nazgul number 6 is the clumsy one.
So we're going to get like a Nazgul equivalent of Dopey?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
After all, the Nazgul in the old Ralph Bakshi version of this, they all had like weird sort of broken ankles and couldn't really walk right. So maybe right. It'll be one of them.
Maybe, yes. Not to mention like the low speed chase to the Ford that happened in the Bakshi version.
So the Bjorn's animals is definitely a fascinating point, Corey. And
yes.
I don't think you're going to be able to wiggle out of this with some kind of, you know, well, they'll come up with a more beastified version of these animals. No, those animals are going to be carrying trays and plates. You'll see.
So we're going to see dogs walking on their hind legs carrying trays.
Yeah, definitely.
That's what you think. Definitely. 100% chance of dogs carrying trays while walking on their back legs.
And there'll be the dwarves will be engaged in a drinking game with some horses.
Right, exactly. Yep. No, I'm all over confident about this.
Mm-hmm. You really don't think that we will get to see talking spiders or talking eagles or talking wolves?
I do. Well, I mean, you know, basically I agree with Sharon. I do think we will probably get some indications that these wolves are not ordinary wolves. You know, we'll be told... and perhaps given some reason to believe it, you know, I mean, that it's like, you know, I'm not sure exactly what kind of unusual wolfly behavior will be shown to us, but basically we'll be told that they're, you know, comparatively intelligent for wolves, and we may well get Gandalf listening in on what they're saying to each other. And, mm-hmm. and now I agree with, again, I've also forgotten
what about,
who said this.
But
anyway, about the speeding up of the thing, the sequence is going to, I'm sure, be faster than it comes across in the, like the, we're not going to be sitting around being like, oh, okay, let's all twiddle our fingers while we're waiting for the goblins to show up. I expect that to be pretty bang, bang.
What about having the wolves like barking at each other and then subtitles? Actually, that in some sense that could look even more ridiculous.
Yeah,
it like,
would.
If they're barking at each other and then it's like, hey, let's go get these guys.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, now let's say some cruel and evil things to each other in our cruel and evil language. That I think would be even more comical. I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all.
yeah, I think that would be kind of ridiculous.
No, not at all. But so, can I? But again, but could I see Gandalf, you know, overhearing them and telling them and like passing on information either then or later?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a good one.
That I can see.
That seems like a reasonable way to handle the wolves. That the wolves will be, we'll hear some kind of barking, growling, howling type noises, and maybe Bilbo will ask what they were saying, and Gandalf will translate it for him. But for the scenes with the eagles, like, don't the eagles talk to the dwarves and Bilbo? They speak directly to them, and we're not going to have any Gandalf staying around to translate that.
Yep.
So
yes, we would, if it happens. Well, let me actually use this as a segue to introduce what our actual prediction question
would
be.
No, wait, actually, I do have I had one other angle I wanted to take at this with you, if you don't mind,
okay.
If you're not just like completely destroyed. I'm kind of wondering, no talking animals in the Lord of the Rings books. Do you think was Tolkien, and especially peculiar is the fact that we don't hear Shelob talk, despite the fact that the Mirkwood spiders talk a lot. Do we think that perhaps if Peter Jackson happens to decide that he doesn't want talking animals in his Hobbit film, is he in fact potentially following along a trajectory Tolkien himself was on? What do you think in his incorporation of the Hobbit into the larger mythic world of Middle-earth, and the more serious mythology, do you think Tolkien himself might have removed the talking animals?
He certainly would have changed some of them. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, you can see some of the changes that he's making in his whole approach to the thing. The trolls would have been different, very different. Had he been writing The Hobbit I remember he started doing this. He rewrote the first several chapters of The Hobbit in the style of The Lord of the Rings. He was going to set out to rewrite it and release like an updated version, basically, like the grown-up version of The Hobbit. Basically, he stopped doing that, like, because everybody hated the idea and nobody liked it. But I think they were right. But anyway, yeah, if that had happened, absolutely. And the spiders, like, it's simply a problem. I wouldn't call it exactly a consistency error, but there's no explanation for it. I mean, and Shelob has actually all kinds of more reason to talk. Now, she doesn't actually speak to them. I could totally buy the, first of all, I wouldn't even go on record as saying, like, I feel confident that Shelob can't talk. Like she's Ungoliant's daughter, for crying out loud. I would totally suspect Shelob of being perfectly capable of speech. And the fact that she doesn't speak doesn't, to me, prove that she can't. What does she have to say? Like, she's not the, like, I shall, like, taunt you and engage in long dialogues before I sting you kind of, you know, villain. So, like, fine. So she doesn't get a villain's monologue. I'm fine with that. So I do think that that's fine. But the spiders in Mirkwood, they have no excuse. They have no excuse to be speaking in the common tongue. That I think would be different. So no, I do think, because you're right, we can see that even within the Lord of the Rings. Remember, we have the moment, you know, the famous thinking fox in chapter 3 of the Fellowship of the Ring, which bothers a lot of people. At the beginning of writing the Lord
the
of the Rings, you know, that when the fox happens by their campsite and sees Frodo and Sam and Pippin and wonders what on earth brings, you know, and we get that internal monologue of the fox, right, thinking to himself, hobbits, three of them. That's not very – this is what bothers people about – you know, there are many Tolkien – fans and scholars. Michael Drought hates the thinking fox.
Not me.
It's not consistent with the rest of the book. This is a shift. We can see tonal shifts happening from chapter 1 of the Fellowship of the Ring starting in chapter 2 and moving up from there. We're just not in that place anymore. The kind of the kind of the ways that we were talking before about the way that Tolkien works comedy in to these moments doesn't happen in the same way at all in The Lord of the Rings that it does in The Hobbit. It's a very different tone. And so, I do think it is basically defensible in those terms. And this is why I wouldn't be offended. This is why I don't consider myself being pessimistic. I don't think of what I'm saying as pessimistic. If Peter Jackson were to go that route, it wouldn't surprise me. And the Eagles, can I talk about the Eagles now? Is that okay?
Yeah. We can move on. Actually, no, wait. One last point.
No, okay,
One last point.
Fine.
Ed Powell brings up an excellent point, several excellent points, in fact, that...
As he is wont to do.
Yes, indeed. That we actually have a lot of talking animals in the Silmarillion.
Yes.
And we have a talking tree, multiple talking trees in The Lord of the Rings. And these characters do not – that talking animals is not identical with humor. Huon the Hound is not a funny guy.
No.
He's awesome.
No. Yes. True. Yeah, no, I agree. And I certainly wouldn't – you know, for exactly those reasons, I'm not saying that we can simply equate that. I would say that within The Hobbit, that is one of the sort of effects of it. Certainly, again, there's very little excuse even for the overheard conversation among the spiders at all. And here I am continually talking about the spiders again. But anyway, there's no excuse for it other than comic relief is almost the only consequence of it. It has almost no other function. Anyway, no, I agree. It's not that like talking animals equals comedy necessarily, but we and I would say, by the way, I don't think the Eagles are funny in the book.
Yeah.
I don't think that the Eagles there is. It's not that they never say anything that's funny. I mean, I'm always amused when the Lord of the Eagles says, you know, we're not going to fly you over where the woodmen live, he says, because they would think we would be after their sheep. And normally, they would be right! And I love that. That cracks me up every time. But that's not like...
It's not goofy humor.
No, that's like me appreciating the sense of humor that the eagle has about this. You know, like But no, it's not... They're not comical.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I don't...
Vanneren Green brings up a good point. Maybe Bilbo just made up the talking animals.
Yeah, you know...
Unreliable narrator.
Unreliable narrator. It's possible.
Probably, it's possible. Probably was drunk half the time he was writing it.
Well, that is a scandalous thing to say.
Okay, so the Eagles. The Eagles.
The Eagles. Okay. So here, basically, let me kind of contextualize this because it does really bear on the question of whether they speak or not. And this is part of my, again, I'm going with no still that as far as they're speaking, but my explanation for that is largely connected with my prediction about our official prediction question. Here is our official prediction question. What role will the Eagles play in The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey? Now, notice the emphasis here. Film one. We're talking because we're fairly confident that the rescuing from burning trees is going to that. First of all, there will be a rescue from burning trees. That image in the scroll certainly seems to suggest that. You know, that moment where we get like, you know, Martin Freeman as Smokey the Bear clinging to the tree while the flames come up. So fairly confident that this will happen and that it will be presumably the only intervention by the Eagles during the course of this film. So, but you know, obviously they're going to come in later on and we're not counting that. But what role will the Eagles play in film one? A, they will save Gandalf et al. From the wargs and goblins and carry them to their eyries. In other words, the book answer, as our option A tends to be. Option B, they will save Gandalf et al. And carry them to Beorn's house. I would also say to the Carrick, if they just take them straight to the Carrick, that would count as B. So like basically, the transportation to Beorn happens right away. They don't go back to their eyries. They just get taken from the trees straight to the greater Beorn neighborhood. Option C, they will save Gandalf et al. And carry them to Radagast's house. That is, thinking about the expanded role that Radagast is going to be playing and knowing that Radagast is famously the friends of birds and beasts, and birds are particularly his friends, that Radagast will be seen to be even possibly behind the rescue of the, that he may even send the eagles, perhaps, to rescue them. So that's option C. Option D is the eagles will help them in some way other than carrying them out of danger. Basically, D is kind of our catch-all answer. You know, all three of the first options assume that they're going to be swept away by eagles out of burning trees, because that seems like the likeliest thing. But maybe that's not exactly how it's going to happen. Maybe the eagles are going to intervene in some other kind of way. And so we wanted to leave option D as open for a radically non-book answer. We have several people who are horrified at the idea of Radagast being involved with this. But admit it, Brandon, Ed, admit it. It's really plausible, isn't it? When you think about it, it's probably why you find this so horrifying. But. You know, it could work. It could work. You know, because remember, if we're gonna have Radagast, you know, if we're like casting Doctor Who as Radagast in this film, then we have to give him a role, right? I mean, he has to do something other than show up and act funny when we're invading the tombs of the Nazgul, whatever they are, and whatever reason we're invading them. So you know, that's pretty plausible. So again, to review, A. Book answer. B, the eagles will take them straight to Beorn without stopping, so that we're not going to have like sleepover with the eagles. That's not going to happen. Okay. Mm-hmm. No pajama party up on the mountains with the eagles. Straight to Beorn's house. Option C, Radagast will be directly involved, and possibly the eagles will deliver them to Radagast, and then Radagast will get them to Beorn. Or whatever, because remember, Beorn knows Radagast, right? He has heard of Radagast and respects him. It is indeed the only reference to Radagast in the Hobbit book, is the fact that Beorn has heard of him. And option D is, again, something else happens. The eagles will help him in some other way than carrying them out of danger. Okay, so we have a lot of votes already. I wasn't gonna pitch in and vote, because you see what I was gonna say. Whoa. Huh? Yeah, so we're getting a lot of voting here.
Yeah, we're being inundated. You know,
with votes.
If people are really excited about voting, what they need to do is they need to go over to the brand new Facebook Riddles in the Dark Predictions page and start registering all their votes there.
That's right. Yeah, and in fact, we will create very soon, like even before the release of the episode, I think we should create the choices for this one, so you guys can register your votes officially on the Facebook page. But yeah, if you guys who are here haven't liked that yet and gone over there, you totally should. So just go onto Facebook and search for Riddles in the Dark Predictions, and you will find the page where we just have poll questions for all of our our prediction questions so far, so you guys can officially register.
Sharon Hoff says she's wavering between B and C. She'll decide on the Riddles in the Dark page.
There you go. That's good
for you.
So okay, Corey? so here's my thing. The reason I don't think we're going to hear the eagles talk is I don't think we're going to see them that much. My prediction, and I'm sorry, I know it's saddening in some ways. I don't think we're getting the pajama party. I don't think we're roasting rabbit and sheep up in the eagles' eyries overnight. I don't think that happens. My prediction is B. I think the eagles are going to take them out of the trees, and they're going to put them down on the Carrick. I assume, by the way, that the Carrick is going to happen because it's awesome, like visually awesome. Like, it's the kind of awesome piece of landscape that they couldn't ever resist doing in the Lord of the Rings films, and I assume they're not going to resist here. There's the opportunity for them to make the Carrick look really cool. So I think they're going to have the Carrick. But anyway, yeah, I think that they're we're we're going to get them. We may have, when they drop them off, as happens in the book, we do get that exchange between Gandalf and the Lord of the Eagles, right, where they do the ritual eagle departure, you know, farewell wherever you fare till your eyries, you know, receive you at your journey's end. And then Gandalf, who knows the proper thing to say in response to that to eagles. We may get some kind of we may get a conversation between Gandalf and the eagle, and then the dwarves being like, dude, what was that about? And he translates it. Like you know, an eagle-ish conversation between them. But basically, my primary reason for thinking we're getting no talking eagles is that I don't think they're going to spend long enough time on screen for us to be hanging out with them and needing conversation.
Do you think they'll carry the dwarves away, but... Oh, you're saying yes. Yeah. Of course you are. You're saying they'll carry them to Bjorn's house, but we won't be, they won't be like hanging out at Bjorn's house.
Nope.
So Yana claims to remember or thinks he remembers seeing an eagle-like location in the trailer. I can't confirm that.
That's in the or production. And maybe. Kate is remembering that too. That's in the scroll. Right, that we can see the eagles hovering. When we get the scene with Gandalf and the bear, there are eagles.
Well, we've already agreed the scroll is an artistic creation.
Right, exactly. That's why I don't necessarily think it proves
artists who couldn't even be bothered to get little details like the contents of Bilbo's dinner table right, so we're not going to take anything they did seriously.
Know. Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, yeah, no. So I think I think yeah. But so okay, Jesse says it very well. He says the established movie eagles are basically a divine shuttle service, and I think they'll remain a shuttle service, not hosts or hotel managers. Exactly. I don't see, especially since basically it would be hard. The night that Bilbo and the dwarves spend in the eyries of the eagles is like their first moment of respite since they've left Elrond's house. You know, they leave Rivendell and they go up in the mountains and they're having a hard time in the mountains. There are stone giants. There's that huge storm that kicks up, and then they go and they camp in that cave, which is peaceful for a very brief time until they're kidnapped by the goblins. And then you get this like, you know, nonstop danger sequence until they have a brief breather when they're all gathered again outside the Misty Mountains. But it's only a very brief breather because they've got to take off again because they know the goblins are going to be pursuing them. So now they're running, and they're being caught up by the wargs, and then they're being set on fire. So when they're finally like rest and eat for the first time in a very, very long time when they get up there. But then they immediately go from there to Bjorn's house where they eat even more and rest even longer. And that kind of a duplication is something – that's the reason I primarily don't see it happening in the film, because I think they're going to want Bjorn's house to be the, okay, now we're finally safe. That particular long action sequence is finally over. To have two separate kinds of sighs of relief is going to be harder. Now, in the book, it's not just duplication at all, of course. It has a very different function.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot to do with sort of what's going on in Bilbo's character, his discomfort in the eagle's eyrie. Like, on the one hand, we're safe and this is nice, but how alien this is. You know, remember the title of the chapter, that is the title of chapter 7 in The Hobbit, which is when starts with Bilbo waking up in the morning in the eagle's eyrie and ends with them, you know, and goes through their trip to Bjorn's house. The title of that is Queer Lodgings, right? So it emphasizes how you have the two different places that they stay, the Eagle's Eyrie and Bjorn's house, which are both strange and bizarre in different ways. So that's, you know, that works and that's very interesting, but I don't see that kind of thing sort of working well enough to have that kind of duplicated in the film. So that's why I don't really expect that.
Works about as well as apparently Ed Powell's iPhone spell check is.
Yeah, I
don't know what you were trying to say there, Ed. Apparently the Eagles do more than U.S. Air.
And I like what it did to Deus Ex Machina. Yeah. His spell check changed that to Deus Ex Machina, which is pretty good. But yes, certainly the Eagles are plenty of Deus Ex Machine.
All right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make my prediction now.
Okay.
I'm going with C.
You're going with C? You're going with the Radagast answer.
You're darn right.
Oh, see, I was tempted. I was bold, but not quite bold enough.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by that notion of maybe Radagast being directly involved, sending the Eagles to rescue them.
Yeah.
I'm going out on a limb. I'm going to go with it.
Okay, but now, Mr. We're Going to See Talking Animals, how do you fit that in? Because, you know, if the Eagles are actually sent by Radagast, then they're knocked down a peg further. Now they're not even independent agents. Now they're just
oh, no,
like...
He didn't send them. He told them what was... He was in communication with them. Yeah. It's an act of collaboration.
Okay, I see. Yeah, so we have more of a working partnership between Radagast and the
That's right. The in fact, I'm pretty sure we're going to end up seeing one of the Eagles telling Radagast the Brown that he owes them one.
Right, right. Okay. All right.
And he's going to pay them by handing over one of his giant rabbits.
Oh, that is wrong. I mean, first of all, how is he ever going to have his sled pulled after that? But I agree, Jan. This is an unusually bold prediction for Dave. He's been going fairly safe recently.
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
the only other possibility I could think of is that apparently the Eagles won't even be involved, and it will be a flight of cold drakes from the Gray Mountains. Because apparently, apparently the company that's producing the miniature figurines for like some table set thing, tabletop game, are producing a Beaufort on Cold Drake figurine.
I don't even know.
You got Trish's email, right?
I did, and I still have just been I feel like, I don't know. I feel like my iPad trying to run Netflix on a really, really bad Wi-Fi connection, buffering and buffering and buffering and not able to process that.
How about Chief Aravir and Dunedain Rangers? I think we should add as a grain of salt that this list of figurines, I don't think we're supposed to read this and assume that everything that's on here will be in the films.
No.
I think these are obviously characters for a board game where you kind of have to innovate. But it's still
no. If we see any dwarf, much less was it Bifer?
It was Beaufort.
For crying out loud. Beaufort. Oh, I see. Oh, well, that's much more plausible. But no, I mean, if we see any dwarf riding on a dragon, I mean, surreal is the word that comes to mind with that. Like, I wouldn't even know how to do it. But anyway, so I'm going to plead the excuse of Ed says boycott time. Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna plead the excuse of that's obviously not a first film issue, and just
and avoid it.
Therefore, give myself several months more to.
I think it would be very entertaining to go down this list and just sort of imagine the possibilities. Hey, first film stuff. Bolg, let's see. Wait, where is it? Bolg and Great Goblin Bodyguard. I'm telling you, I'm telling you, I originally predicted
Goblin Bodyguard.
I originally predicted that Azog would be the recurring goblin fiend that would be popping up here and there to trouble the dwarves in order to build his character. But I think Bolg would also be a fantastic choice for that role. The goblin who seems to be at every scene in which there's danger. Yep, there he is again.
maybe. I'm gonna.
Okay.
Well, we need to come back and do more with the goblins anyway. We haven't even talked about the kidnapping scene.
Or going down to Goblin Town.
Down to Goblin Town. Yeah, exactly. We've got to do an episode on that. So let's not save this right now.
I do think at some point we'll have to just go down this list and imagine the possibility. I do have one I want to run by you because I want to check my Hobbit trivia to see if I remember this correctly.
Okay.
One of the figurines listed is Turin the Dragon Slayer.
Awesome.
I was driving Trish around today through LA and we were talking about it and she was like, how the heck is he involved?
He's there. To
recall that Smaug has like a dream or a nightmare that involves.
Exactly. There is what I believe to be a reference, not by name, to Turin Turambar. It is of course like a reference which literally nobody could get because, I guess C.S. Lewis could have gotten it. Because he'd read some of Tolkien's other stuff. I do believe, and not everybody agrees with me. There are other ways to read the passage, but yes, that dream that Smaug has a dream of a warrior altogether insignificant in size, but armed with a bitter sword, and great courage. That figure features most uncomfortably in this dream that he has. John Ratliff in The History of the Hobbit believes that, you know, it suggests the reading that the dream is of Bilbo, that he's having like a prophetic dream of, or sort of a strange alternate universe predictive dream of Bilbo, because of course in the original drafts, in the original scheme of The Hobbit, the original manuscript notes, Tolkien was going to originally make Bilbo kill Smaug. Bard didn't exist as a character. He was a late addition to the story. And Bilbo was going to be like, the dwarves going to be like, we don't know how to get rid of the dragon. And Bilbo was going to go down and he was going to stab Smaug to death and then be floated out the door on a river of Smaug's blood. True story. And he was going to be doused in the blood and thereby changed. This was going to have some either physiological or it, at the very least psychological impact on him, which of course is consistent with Norse mythology. This is what happens to Sigurd when he is bathed in the blood of Fafnir the dragon. So anyway, that was like the original scheme, and then he dropped it. But so Ratliff's argument is that when Smaug has the vision of the warrior altogether insignificant in size, but armed with a bitter sword, that basically this is sort of like Tolkien's nod to the original version of Bilbo. But I don't think so. I think that the fact that he calls him altogether insignificant in size does not to me at all prove that it is a hobbit that he is envisioning. I think that basically a human warrior, Smaug, would also consider altogether insignificant in size. That is, certainly he would not look at any human warrior, even the greatest among the human warriors, and say, like, oh, dude, that guy might be a match for me. Like, Smaug looks down on all bipeds. So he is going to... So I think that if he saw Turin Turambar, he would also consider him altogether insignificant in size. But yes, of course, this is within Tolkien's works, within Tolkien's body of work. Smaug is very conspicuous. Smaug and Glaurung are Tolkien's two dragons. Like, yes, we get Enkhaligan the Black, but we don't get him. That is, he's never depicted. Glaurung and Smaug are the only two real dragons that we get stories about. Mm-hmm. And Turin Turambar killed... So like basically, within the like world of lore that Smaug has in his own, you know, like racial memory or like whatever legends dragons tell amongst themselves, there will be the story of Turin Turambar, who mm-hmm. killed the prototype dragon, who killed Dragon 1.0, Glaurung the Golden, by stabbing him with his bitter sword. And if there is a sword in the history of fiction that could be called a bitter sword, it would be Turin's.
The reference is too good.
I totally think so. If this game has Turin Turambar, like, is actually reading Turin Turambar into that, I will be like all kinds of incredibly impressed, which then makes me puzzled all the more about Bofur and Goldrakes. Whatever. Like, I find those two things utterly irreconcilable. But not that I think that we're going to get a Turin Turambar cameo.
That's an interesting question. Ed Powell, film. How did they get the rights to Turin?
But, you know, I don't know, maybe we should stop talking about this. No, I have no idea.
Yeah,
no idea.
Maybe that's why he's called Turin the Dragon Slayer and not Turin Turambar.
Yeah,
they don't actually own the rights to the name Turin. But if it was Turin Turambar, then maybe it'd be a little more obvious. Ah,
well, see, Turin's name is mentioned in The Lord of the Rings, so yes.
You're right.
fair use.
That's fair use.
We get a couple of references to Turin. Not to mention, of course, another explicit parallel. Turin is actually kind of all over The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, or at least surprisingly, for, you know, you wouldn't expect it. I mean, of course, the other major reference to Turin, double reference to Turin, is in Sam with Shelob. Mm-hmm. Sam stabs up underneath Shelob just like Turin. The reference to Turin by name is in that passage that no one, you know, no blade, not though the hand of Beren or of Turin wield it, could have stabbed up into Shelob. So Turin's hand stabbed Glaurung from underneath and killed him, but not even Turin with his sword could have punctured Shelob as badly as Sam did because it was Shelob's own malice that bore her down upon his way. But then there's also the fact that Sam, immediately after being put in the same position of Turin and implicitly compared to Turin, then afterwards contemplates suicide by throwing himself off a cliff. So Turin and Nienor are all over that scene.
Yep.
But absolutely no way, man. No lawyers could come after them because Turin is there. And the other reference to Turin, by the way, counterintuitively, is by Elrond at the end of the Council of Elrond Elrond tells Frodo he's going to join the Elf Friend Hall of Fame, and the three members of the Elf Friend Hall of Fame that he lists that Frodo is going to join are Beren and Húrin and Turin.
Frickin' Tur got screwed over.
Yeah, Tur was a pretty big... I mean, especially since that was Grandpa, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, come on, Elrond, get it together. He's a way better guy.
You gotta give a little love to Grandpa, right?
So, okay. One last question before we go. from Vanarin. If they make a movie of the Children of Húrin, Talking Sword...
Gosh, that's a hard one. And it's, I mean, this might seem really strange. Like, here I am blithely saying the Eagles, you know, I'm like, Eagles, no way, man. The Eagles aren't going to talk. But I'm like, oh, but the sword must talk, right? I mean, clearly you'd put the talking sword on screen. Talking Eagles, forget about it. But talking swords, yeah. But I am actually tempted to say yes. That scene is too iconic. It's not like this is not a Troll's Purse we're talking about. I mean, this is, that moment is such a signature moment in the Turin story. I don't know, man. To have some kind of voice, like what I could see is Turin holding his sword and monologuing, right? And then just like to have a voice, like a whisper, which you are left to like wonder, like who's talking to him? Like, is this just like an internal dialogue? You know, is this is like Turin, who is like not altogether, you know, with us at that point? Is he just hearing voices or something?
That is one way to interpret the actual,
right,
even the book itself.
Exactly. Like, or is this like, you know, the malice of Morgoth egging him on in some way? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, I think that it could be done with, in such a way as not to appear kind of jarring, as frankly, that scene often is jarring in,
yes,
the book. I mean, I've known many a reader jarred by the fact that Turin's sword talks back to him, in the final moment.
Or you could go the other direction and turn it into a Lord Voldemort Horcrux type scene.
You could, I guess. You could. I don't think you would want to.
No. You didn't even want to do it with Lord Voldemort.
No. No. But anyway, yeah.
All right.
Well, okay. We have now digressed far enough, but
we have. Whenever we land on Harry Potter, it's time to end the episode.
Yeah, that's pretty much. We're pretty much.
I mean, at least we didn't get to Twilight.
Done. Yeah, despite Ed's efforts, no, I totally resisted Ed's trying to goad me into making a comment about Twilight. So there we have it.
yeah, just noted that. Wow. Oh yeah, no, so but anyway, we did,
okay,
just make a reference to it.
What, by saying we weren't going to make a reference to it?
They tricked us.
Yes.
Tricksy
Damn
little
it.
Listeners.
Confound it. All right. Fine.
So okay.
I think we're good.
Final prediction question. How will the Eagles be involved? You guess they will fly them directly to Beorn. I guess they will fly them.
Or the Carrick. Carrick, yep, counts.
Yeah. Or the Carrick. Yep. Carrick counts.
Yeah.
I surprised everyone and chose that they would fly them directly to Radagast the Brown. And I'll be interested to see what everybody else has to say. We already know what Mark Fisher's answer will be.
You're so unrelenting with poor Mark. He has not, in fact, guessed A every time.
Not only is he not guessed A every time. I don't think he hasn't guessed A like.
Since you started teasing him mercilessly,
yeah,
for doing so.
He guessed A 6 times in a row and hasn't guessed it since.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. We browbeat him about it so much that now he's forcing himself to guess other things. So.
Yeah, excellent. I hope you're proud of yourself.
Thank you.
So, okay. Good.
Right.
Well, anyway, so thanks again, everybody, for joining us. We actually had, we peaked at about 20 people, I think, 20 people joining us at what is now 1 a.m. Eastern time. Though I think actually some very early rising Europeans have joined us, it's now 6 a.m. over in Greenwich Mean Time.
I bet Father Roderick is listening. If you're listening, Father Roderick.
That's right. So anyway, so get thanks, effusive thanks once again for you guys joining us at a very inconvenient hour and on extremely short notice. This has been a lot of fun. Yes, Yana started at 5. Yana, I saw you show up, and I couldn't believe you joined us. Yeah, like midnight. I couldn't believe that. So anyway.
Yep.
So thanks everybody for joining us, and I should be checking in from the Return of the Ring at some point.
We expect you to live tweet the whole event.
Live tweet the entire 5-day conference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably won't do that, but maybe I will try some.
Go find what's his full name? Emil, the Lord of the Rings project guy.
Oh yeah, he's going to be there at the Return of the Ring?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, I am really excited about the opportunity to, because I think there are a bunch of people that I have gotten to know through my podcast who are based in Europe who are going to be there, because it's much easier, of course, to get there from places like Denmark and Germany and Sweden than it is to get to anything over here. So I'm definitely looking forward to getting the chance to connect with people that I don't normally get a chance to do. So anyway,
yeah, so,
should be a lot of fun.
Emil Johansson, Johansson,
yes.
And he says he's going to be he's going to be there.
Fantastic.
Yeah, go
Definitely say
hi to him and tell and get all of his predictions.
Okay.
Because he's
cool.
Joining our analysts.
Yeah.
All right.
Fantastic. All right. Excellent. Well, thanks very much. At us where it is. It is in Loughborough, England. That is precisely where it shall be. So thanks very much for joining us, everybody, and we will see you. I'll be back, Lena, so we should be able to have our next broadcast in about 2 weeks. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us. Had a great time, and I will say goodnight. Thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.